It is with great pleasure that I have the honor of introducing Paul Hughes to this version of Dirigent Loftet, this series of pods where we discuss many different things and many different topics. Paul, can I ask you to introduce yourself?
Yes, Andreas, thank you very much for having me on the program. I'm Paul Hughes. Recently moved from being 23 years as director at the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Chorus and BBC Singers, but a lifetime in largely managing artists, managing orchestras, programming orchestras, and now a lot of teaching, mentoring young conductors, composers, musicians. Yeah, and great to be here doing this session with you.
And my name is Andreas Hansson. I'm a conductor, as some of you may know, mainly in the wind field and the brass field here in Norway, but also doing some orchestral things all over Scandinavia. We are supposed to talk about programming today, and that's our main topic. Is programming an art?
Oh, it is absolutely an art. It's a skill. It's a dark art, some would say. It's a mysterious art that we don't often share publicly, but sits at the heart of absolutely everything that we do. And getting it right is as hard as getting a dish right or getting a meal right. Just the right combination of pieces for the right context, for the right audience. I love it. Mm. And particularly as the director of an orchestra where one's dealing with an awful lot of things all at the same time, political things, financial things, administrative things, the programming is the best bit of the job. It's the most creative part of the job.
I had a teacher in choral conducting who said that it's actually a life question, or a question of life and death. He put it very...
It's probably more important than that.
Yeah. But anyway, I carry this with me all the time because for me it's also... Do you agree if I say it's an important way of developing the orchestra that you may conduct or that you are in charge of, the choice of repertoire in the long sense?
Yeah, it's an important part of developing the orchestra for two reasons. One is in terms of the repertoire that you're playing and the kind of sound and the kind of orchestra you want it to become, but also the engagement of the orchestra in that programming process, I think, is an important stage in the development of an orchestra. The fact that it feels confident and that its management, if you like, feels confident in tapping into that vast resource of knowledge that an orchestra has about repertoire, about other artists, conductors and composers, when you come to put the programming together. Mm. Not that it's a democratic process, but capitalizing on all of that knowledge, I think one would be foolish not to do that. Mm.
But how do you do that? I mean, an orchestra, a symphony orchestra, is nearly 1,000 years of experience, right? Or a big wind orchestra of 60 players. How do you make it democratic? How do you listen? With your experience, how do you listen to the orchestra? How is this done?
Well, this is an interesting question that sort of strays slightly off programming, really. But how you take a highly managed structure like an orchestra that's... let's say a contract orchestra that is told what to play, when to play, how to play it, what to wear, when they can have a break, and so on and so on. And then you ask questions, you ask opinions, you ask views. What do you think we should be playing? What conductor do you think we should be using? Where do you think we should be playing it? It takes a long time for that to become a fruitful exercise with people who are not used to being asked, and whose views are perhaps not often listened to and acted upon. And I think that takes a certain degree of maturity and persistence in asking somebody, what do you think? And then acting on that. Because if you don't act on it, there's no point in asking them what they think. But I always took the view when I was planning, let's say, the whole season of the BBC Symphony Orchestra with my staff colleagues, it's a lot to do. You're looking at, what, 25, 28, 30 different programs in a season. And frankly, I needed help. And the orchestra is a great resource for that once they understood the role that they would have into that process And that took a while.
Do you think there is a difference between what an orchestra need to play or want to play?
Oh, yes. A bit like conductors. The conductors that they want to have working with them and the conductors that they need to have working with them are very different. Depends what you want to achieve in terms of you know, balance in the season. And I think presenting a season of repertoire that an orchestra can understand why they're playing it, whether they like it initially or not, or whether they would rather always play something else, it's as long as the rationale for programming a particular piece, especially if it's a new piece of music, and they trust us as programmers, you, me, as programmers, to present them with music that you know is going to be rewarding, satisfying, challenging, and you know have an impact on the listening public. That takes a while, but that trust underpins everything and allows you to do things which perhaps they're not familiar with.
How do you know when you win the trust from a group? Or now we're talking about a professional symphony orchestra, but I think this can be, you can apply this on every level actually. But how do you know when you, so to speak, win their trust in terms of repertoire?
Perhaps I can give an example. For an orchestra trying to reach new audiences, there's a number of ways you can do it. You can probably spend quite a lot of money in a massive marketing campaign to try and persuade more people to come to what you're going to do. Yeah, that's one rather expensive solution. The other way is to take different types of projects, orchestrally based, to meet a different community completely. That might be a different ethnic community. It might be a community that's more interested in the visual arts or in literature or in drama or film, whatever. But taking an orchestral product, if you like, based on fantastic repertoire that makes the orchestra, who might be feeling a little bit anxious because it's not what they're used to. It's not in a place that they're used to, perhaps. It's not an audience that they're used to seeing. But making sure that it is always of the highest possible quality, and that doing a concert with, let's say, the conductor Jules Buckley and urban artists, you know, rock and pop, rappers, whatever, with really sophisticated arrangements with lighting and smoke and big loudspeakers. I knew I'd got the trust of the orchestra when at the end of that concert they all came off and said, that was fantastic, we should do more of that. Mm. But that wouldn't have been possible before because it was an orchestra that had a particularly narrow sense of itself as being a great orchestra playing great repertoire by dead white guys mostly and some of this new music that we have to play. But broadening out that repertoire in order to attract new audiences and take the orchestra out to places that perhaps wouldn't expect to see them has only been possible knowing that I've got that trust.
Talking about dead white guys, how do you follow up? Let's say we do this smoke lightning things with a combination with another music form, and it's a success as you mentioned. How do we follow that up without losing the old white guys? Because most of us, I think, would like to keep some Brahms or some Beethoven in our repertoire. Just, do you understand what I mean? Moving forward without losing what we stand on.
Well, you know, my view about that is these are not either or. We want them both. Mm. We want it all. And why shouldn't we have it all? You know, an orchestra is a fantastic entity that isn't designed to just play one thing any more than in Beethoven's day they could ever conceive that they would be playing Shostakovich or Rachmaninoff or Tchaikovsky or whatever. So for me, that sense of being able to do both is when an orchestra has confidence in itself and it knows that it can do it well and it can do it. It's Brahms and Mahler and Tchaikovsky and Turnage and John Adams and so on fabulously, but it can also turn its hand to doing a concert with Brian Cox about the planets with a 2,000 kids would-be scientists or a concert with Paul Weller or a concert with Zadie Smith or Neil Gaiman. And just, it's about trust that you're always going to do the highest possible quality, whatever it is that you're doing as an orchestra. And that's, That for me is what a 21st century orchestra and a 21st century programmer needs to think about.
Do you think that in general that we are courageous enough when it comes to mixing art forms? I mean, sometimes, occasionally, you can feel that it's a little bit superficial just to create a kind of new thing. But if you do it carefully, it can be brilliant, of course. But do we do it enough? I mean, mixing literature music or dance music, etc., going away from ballet or melodrama or operetta, but other combinations of art forms. Are we doing enough, or could we be even more? Can we have more fantasy when it comes to this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think we can. But you touched on the crucial point. It has to be brilliantly well done. And we've seen concerts, you know, with a wonderful orchestra playing marvelous repertoire, and somebody's come in and thought, "Well, this would be fantastic if we had smoke and lights and a glitter ball and all the rest of it, you know, to add and screens." Unless there's a very clear rationale as to why that is, it's very superficial, and the orchestra and the audience feel confused and slightly betrayed. Whereas collaborating with other artists, other art forms, other genres, on your own terms, on orchestral terms, I don't know why more of that isn't done. I mean, the series of concerts that I had devised over the last 8 years in the BBC Symphony Orchestra, working with very famous authors whose books sell millions of copies and are internationally well known, that they come and they read extracts from their books, and one curates a program of music that fits in between and continues that narrative. The point is that you're reaching a whole new raft of audience, people who are coming to hear Ian McEwan or Zadie Smith or Neil Gaiman. And in the process, they're hearing Frank Zappa and Mason Bates and John Adams and Tchaikovsky and Dukar and whatever it might be from a symphony orchestra. And they may well never have heard a symphony orchestra before, but they're coming to hear that. I don't know why. I mean, the orchestra, I think, now does at least one of those every year, and the latest one's coming up in April. But they always do well, and they always reach a completely new audience. Mm. And that's what I mean about being confident in the quality of what you're doing in creating a collaboration like that, and just having the idea.
But that also puts the demands on you as a programmer, right? Because you need to have your finger just in the air, as we say in Scandinavia, which means being sensible for what's moving around our little music world. How do you do that as a programmer? I mean, if you say a book by an author who sold a million copies, it's very obvious. But if you want to do something that is not so known, how do you find it? I mean, it must take time, right? Or
it does. Interest, but to use that example again about the authors, the first one that we did was with David Sedaris, and I was just listening to a podcast that he did, and you just have to have the idea. What if? Wouldn't it be interesting? I love his writing. Really find that dry black humor appeals to me. Wouldn't it be great if we could do something like that with the orchestra and reach a new audience? So it's having that idea and allowing those ideas in, coming from wherever they might be, left of field. You might think it's completely crazy. How could you bring, you know, a famous chef and an orchestra together to work? Have the idea first and work out the details later. But just having the idea and the imagination and then the understanding exactly what that journey is. This is why we're doing it. This is the audience we're aiming to reach. And when people say, how do you make your orchestra relevant, that awful word, you know, to more of society? Well, these are ways in which you can do it. You can introduce a symphony orchestra and its fabulous sound to a whole range of people that would never normally have gone to the Barbican and booked a ticket and come to a concert.
And when you think about it this way, it sort of confirms that it's an art form, because it comes up to you. It's up to you as a program director or whatever title you've got to mix it into a new work of art, isn't it?
It is, in a way. And you kind of got to be confident. And also, I joke slightly flippantly, but there is an element of truth in this. You know, when you've programmed for years and years and years, one season, you want to stop yourself from being bored. So you just think, oh, well, let's just do some weird shit, something unusual. Mm. What might it be? What could we do? And once you sort of have that internal conversation, if you like, and you open your mind up to thinking about doing things in a different way, then it becomes a question of quality and, if you like, translating it into terms that, first of all, the orchestra will respect and understand, and then presenting the message to the audience so that they know what the proposition is. And it may not be your core audience. You may be reaching a completely different audience. And an audience, for example, that might book tickets 2 weeks ahead of time. No good putting it on sale 6 months ahead of time, because nobody will take the slightest bit of notice for certain types of the community. So just, you know, researching, knowing the community that you want to reach, and always making sure that whatever it is that you're planning is super high quality and challenging and rewarding for the orchestra as well.
And in addition to that, a rhetorical question that we need to ask, do we know what the audience wants?
No. No, we don't. Our job is to lead them to the music that they're going to love tomorrow. They might, if you ask an audience, you know, what would you like to play? And they, you know, I say, well, I love, you know, Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony. I love Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto Number 1, whatever. After a while of being asked what they want, they say, I don't know, surprise me. Give me a dish I've never tried before.
It's like food, actually.
It's exactly like food. Mm. Yeah. So, but it's, again, it's about trust and consistency of message, so that if you're going to take your audience in a different direction, don't just spring it on them without any kind of preparation, but really communicate it with them, you know, through social media, through your marketing, through your messaging, through your comms, whatever it might be, so that you're building an anticipation, an expectation of something different, rather than trying to sort of slip it in and hope that perhaps they won't notice it in the way that you might feed a child vegetables. You know, there's an ice cream, I don't know if you have it over here, there's an ice cream brand in the UK that has vegetables in it, designed for kids that won't eat vegetables. Some programming is a bit like that. And I love vegetables, but I don't enjoy that concept.
So now we're talking, we have a great deal of listeners who doesn't really do their work on the BBC Symphony Orchestra level, but maybe as a community band or a community string orchestra and so. All the things that we are talking about now, is that applicable on every level, or what do you think about that? Because there are other things to look for in that circumstances.
I think the basic principles are absolutely applicable in any circumstance. If you're conducting your local church choir, or you're conducting a band of volunteer musicians who, you know, will, you know, give their time and rock up each week, and they want to be engaged, they want to be stimulated, and they want to have a good time socially as well as musically. So I think thinking about repertoire not just from the point of view of what you as a conductor might want, but what they might want to play and what the audience might want to hear or be enchanted by, if you like, or stimulated by, surprised by. So balancing all of those elements, it's just that the ratio of weight that you attach to each of those things might be different. And with volunteers, it's got to be something which they can play, but is sufficiently challenging to feel that they've got somewhere when they do perform it, and something that they really look forward to.
How do you learn this?
Well, you and I both now spend a lot of time talking to young conductors about how to program, and I learned it on the job, I suppose. You know, the first orchestra that I had to program consistently was the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. And in those days, you'd sort of sit. I remember I used to do programming on the floor. I'd sit on the floor and I'd get all the Groves dictionaries lay out and this pile of CDs and all the old season brochures and stuff like that, you know, and notes and pieces of paper and stuff. And the office floor would be covered. And you're sort of learning the skills. But I think we were talking about this earlier on, that my earliest experiences of programming were at school, in putting on concerts that you might want to play in and you want your mates to play in, and you order the pieces that you think you would enjoy without any thought about the audience. You know, they were kind of an added extra that wasn't necessarily one's responsibility then. But it's only in later years, and well, there's a commercial imperative that you understand the relationship between what you put on and your ultimate survival.
Because I find a question that at conducting seminars, a question that is often raised is, how do I find the repertoire? Which is a very broad question, but sometimes I am asked for methods for this. Which
what do you tell them?
Well, I tell them a lot of things. For instance, my dad always told me to choose one piece of music, you need to read 10, and that is read, not listen. Read. He was quite tough with this, reading the score before listening to it, and he's got a point there, my dad, actually, because it's when you read those 10 scores, you will probably find another piece that fits into another program later on. And listen, go to concerts.
Yes.
I'm a little bit worried about music students these days because I don't see too many of them at concerts.
Look, I think there is a reason for that. And certainly the students that are at the conservatoires that I teach at, they are so busy doing it because there are so many more performing opportunities than when I was at college, that they're doing it all the time, or they're doing it outside college all the time with their own orchestras, that they might think they go to concerts, but they don't really much. And I don't know how forensic their listening is when they're at a concert, what they're thinking about, whether or not they're gauging what an audience reaction is around them. You know how when you're sitting in an audience, you can sense what's going on. You can feel whether they're connected or not in relation to a particular performance or a particular piece. And for me, we were talking about going to concerts and listening to program pieces in a program and thinking about other programs at the same time. Maybe that's a sickness, I don't know, but it feels to me that sometimes you just can't stop thinking about programming. It's the creative engine that drives absolutely everything that a conductor does. Without that, you can't, you know, you couldn't cook a meal if you didn't know what ingredients were available.
For me, it's usually a chain of associations, actually, that I hear a piece that I sort of in the outskirts connect with another piece by the same composer, which is a little bit connected to something else, and it sort of moves that chain of associations, but it's actually based on knowing a repertoire as well. Otherwise, you can't do the association.
It is, but it's the muscle that we're trying to develop in young conductors and young musicians, that muscle of curiosity, of making those connections so that they spring to mind, you know, and you might be hearing a piece by a composer you don't know. And, you know, I would want to then go away and find out what was going on politically, socially around that time. Who is this person? You know, who do they study with? Who did they teach anybody? So we're able to make those connections all the time so that the programming has an integrity on paper that then has to work musically for an audience that may not know what those connections are, but that musically it has to work. And that's where the joys of having something like Spotify exists, because you can make these playlists of your fantasy programs, and you can order the program pieces in a different way for a different effect and a different impact, and sit down and think this sequence of pieces that I think would work together. Then you sit and listen to it and you think, actually, no, it's not quite what I thought it was. And that's something which was so much harder when I started out in the business, but it's so much easier now, and trying to encourage the students I teach to use these tools and to use things like YouTube, where I'm looking at something, maybe an artist I'm not familiar with, and on the side it's saying, you know, you listen to this, have a listen to this as well, you might like this, a bit like Amazon's algorithms, you know. And 2 hours later you're still noodling through all this stuff, you know, and you've made a dozen notes about things that you'd never heard of, or artists you've never seen before. And these are just the ways in which, if you've the right mind, I mean, there's a lot of stuff I can't remember, stuff that I don't feel I need to remember. You know, it goes in one ear and out the other. But programming, pieces, repertoire, durations, orchestrations, it just sticks.
It's far away from making that cassette tape, right? When with your favorite pieces and sort of taking them from the LP down to the cassette just to get them in a certain order.
Well, when I was a schoolboy, my dad had this elderly cousin who loved classical music. She was the only person in our family who I thought did. And I used to make what I now see back was a playlist. I'd send her cassettes of pieces that I really liked and I thought would work in a sequence. And I'd mail them off to her. She lived up in York. And it's funny when you look back on a life, on a career, whatever, you know, you can see where the programming muscle was just starting to be flexed. I hadn't thought about that until now, but yeah, that's partly also from wanting to share the music I love with other people and never ever thinking that I would be in a position of being able to share that, you know, with the world professionally.
Do you ever get stuck in programming?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
What do you do then? What is the medicine?
There's a magic process, and I don't know what it is exactly, but when you're planning a whole season, or sometimes when you're just planning a concert like this one we've got coming up in April with Kate Atkinson, the author, you get in the middle and you say, oh, I don't know, I'm done in. I have no new ideas. I'm stuck. And you kind of leave it, and then you can come back to it, and the next thing you know, it's done, and you think, oh yeah, actually that's... And sometimes you just need to step away from it. In the way that if you're commissioning a new piece of music from a composer, and they contact you to say, you know, I'm having real problems with this. I'm just stuck. I can't. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to reach the deadline. The worst thing you can do is put pressure on that. You have to say, that's fine. Don't worry. Just we'll do a different piece of yours, and we'll do that when you're ready. You know, just take a breather and step away from it. And just lifting that pressure is often enough to release the creativity again, and they finish the piece. I mean, in almost every single case I can think of. And it's a bit like that with programming. You get stuck and you just... Or I might take it to the orchestra artistic advisory group or to one of my colleagues and say, I just need just this right, this one piece that's missing in this program, sort of bind it together. And sometimes it's hard to explain what the intellectual thing you have inside you that's gluing that program together. And you just know it's not quite right.
I had a composition teacher when I started to be a conductor, but we had a little portion of a composition, and he made us do an exercise which I use in programming sometimes. And he said, if I ask you to write a melody, you will get something in your head, hopefully. Do the opposite. So it's a kind of artistic U-turn. So Instead of saying, we need to do Shostakovich. I really want to do Shostakovich, but it doesn't work. How about Purcell? That U-turn. Have you ever tried that? Just change the program completely to get it right.
Well, sometimes you've had to. In London, for example, it's a very crowded marketplace. It's got 5 symphony orchestras and 2 major concert halls. And sometimes you want to do a piece because you've got this fantastic, perfectly formed program, and you can't because somebody else is doing that piece. Then, and you always go through that sort of, you know, metaphorical ripping out of your hair and thinking, damn it, that's the great program. But there's always an alternative. But I love that idea, you know, get rid of the Shostakovich and bring Purcell in. And take the program in a completely different direction. I'm going to steal that.
Just to loosen it a little bit. It works for me sometimes, but.
Well, and I say to the students that I teach, you know, always have an ideas dump in your laptop, you know. So a good idea that you can't use it, it'll come back. Use it another time. Composers do the same, but for programmers, you know, a program that you think is really good, but you can't do right now for whatever reason, just put it in the box and come back to it later.
Having your experience and you've been working so long in this field on this level, do you still have holes to fill in your knowledge when it comes to repertoire? Or rather, are you still curious after all these years to find new repertoire?
Oh yeah, very much so. For example, I'm now programming more chamber music than I used to. I was mostly programming symphonic music, so I'm rapidly hoovering up and discovering and pushing the boundaries of chamber music that I like. I recently found a piece that I'm planning to program for four string quartets at the same time, which is a great piece written in 1845 by Johannes van Brie, Dutch composer. It's a really good piece. And from that, and you know, the short answer is yes, the curiosity is still there. And I suppose it's now, it's new music that I love, and it's how you create new sensations and experiences for an audience by juxtaposing new music, music that they're unfamiliar with either music that they are familiar with or unfamiliar pieces by composers they are familiar with. And it's almost limitless, the combinations you can have, and getting it just the right combination is still, for me, you know, the most creative part of what I do.
If you consider the art of programming, if we use that term, this is a leading question, but I would like us to talk about it. How about things around the actual composition? For a young conductor, is it important to know, to put a piece in a historical perspective or in a context with other pieces? By myself, for instance, I try to, if I'm supposed to conduct Symphony Number 7 by the composer X. I always listen to Symphony Number 6 and Number 8 as well.
Yeah.
Is this a good thing, or is it time wasting to? I mean, I go as far as reading literature from that period, or paintings, or whatever. Now we're talking about a little bit the dead white guys.
Yeah, but I think context is absolutely everything, and politically, socially, culturally, what else was happening around the time of a piece by, you know, a no longer living composer, to use an example. But to take Vaughan Williams as an example, if you were to listen to the Fifth Symphony, you would think, okay, that's a great piece, I like that. If you listen to the Fourth and the Sixth, you'd think, is this the same composer? And so trying to get as full a range of possible as where this composer's come from. It's like commissioning a piece from a composer whose music you've heard and you like, and you commission a piece thinking you're getting one thing, and they think, well, actually, I'm going to take it in a different direction and I'm going to do that. And that's both a risk and the excitement of commissioning, because when it arrives on the desk and you look at it, you think, well, that wasn't what I was expecting. You know, it doesn't look or sound like anything that we've done before.
But we have many proofs that that's the way to make the music move forward, right?
Completely. Absolutely right. Yeah, otherwise it's the same stuff all the time.
And it becomes boring if it sounds the same, right?
It does. And I think for a young conductor, putting a program together and having to frame the program now for a piece that isn't going to be ready for another year, you know, the kind of conversations that they need to have with that composer in order to create the right context and framework for that piece, you know, developing the ability to have those conversations is a large part of the teaching that I do now when I bring composers and conductors together. How do you talk about your practice? How do you talk about your work? How do you describe your music? Not in a way that's going to say, you know, this is how I write and this is how the piece I'm going to write is going to sound like, but just talk about yourself so that when I, as a programmer, come to put a program together with your new piece in, there's a good chance that I've put it in the right place on the program and surrounded it by the right pieces. Because for me, the new piece, however big the rest of the program is, the new piece is the most important piece, because the responsibility is greater on that than it is to the dead white guy. God rest them.
So in our next episode, Paul and I will continue our discussion and maybe go down a little bit more into the craft of the conductor or the programmer or the leader, the artistic leader of a music group. Thank you for listening.
Du hørte på Dirigentloftet. I studio i dag var Andreas Hansson og Paul Hughes. Tekniker Sverker Rundqvist. På saxofon Petter Vettre.